Position number 612523.
Mr. Hale, tape 3. Yes, you were saying about joining the bands in the red light.
Yes, we went down to the red light district where they had their dance orchestras going. Usually used to be about a 7-piece orchestra, I suppose. And our saxophone player used to take the saxophone, I used to take the piano, the drummer would take the drums, and any member of our band used to go down. We used to just sit in and have a go. And until we were due back in barracks, you usually had a pass until midnight. Our barracks was known as Murray Barracks. We were in Queen's Road. Barracks, they were double-storey barracks. There was a basement where, if I remember correctly, the washhouses and bathhouses used to be. And then above that, there was one other floor with parquet flooring. And then there was another floor above that with the sergeant bunks at either end. We used to overlook a roadway, which was called Garden Road. We were in Murray Barracks, overlooking Garden Road. And there were 5 or 6 blocks of these, with some ancillary buildings in there, like the medical inspection room, the MT section where we used to keep our 1500-weight Morris Coms trucks. they were all in there. And stores, officers' mess, that was right on, that was in the block right opposite the roadway. Underneath the officers' block, we had a fairly large room where we used to hold our orchestral practice. I hired my own piano from Chang Fuchs. It was a very, very modest rental, but it was a better pianist than the piano than the one we had for the band. We used to keep that one up in the top block, and I was able to use mine for orchestral practice. Otherwise, it meant that the piano used to have to be carried from the top block right the way all down 2 flights of stairs, down through the whole of the barracks, down to the bottom block, and it used to be dropped around and used to naturally get out of tune. So I hired my own piano, so we were able to leave the pianos where they were. But when we went back to with my wife to Hong Kong in 1975 and more recently in 1978, of Murray Barracks, there's only one block standing now, which is the officers' blocks, where we used to overlook Garden Road, and just beyond that used to be the Parade Square, where we used to not only parade for the adjutants, RSMs and GOCs parades, quite a big area. We used to play football there. In fact, we used to do some MOT work used to be done over there. That is now the Hilton Hotel, a massive block, like 40 stories. And as I say, there's only one building left now of the old Murray Barracks, and that is now a rating office. And behind that, where the other buildings used to be, is nothing else but a car park. You go up a little bit further, running along, which is now the car park, Victoria Barracks. That's all being changed. And General Officer Commanding Flagstaff House, where we used to play at various receptions, that's all torn. Howard, to go back to my pre-war days in Hong Kong, we played at quite a number of Chinese functions. They used to be fascinating. Any weddings we were going, we used to play small orchestra for the tea. They used to hold perhaps a tea dance where we used to play small orchestra. Then later in the evening, perhaps a couple of hours later, one of the big halls at the Kowloon Cricket Club or the Portuguese clubs, civil service clubs, various clubs that was going had big halls. They used to be hired, and we'd play for the evening function. Used to usually be a dance, and we'd play right up to 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. New Year's Eve, of course, very, very big thing, both in India and in Hong Kong, and we used to be perhaps engaged to play up to 4 o'clock in the morning. And the people who were running the dance used to come up to us and say, "Can we play another couple of hours? We'll make it all right. We'll send a hat round for you." And we were only too pleased to play for another couple of hours.
When you played for Chinese weddings, what sort of Chinese people were they?
Oh, they used to be usually lovely. The girls, Chinese girls, majority of them always do look very, very attractive. But the weddings that we played at were usually the very, very wealthy people, and everything was laid on. We used to play very often in private houses and places they used to call, or we used to refer to them as castles. We used to play in a musician's balcony overlooking the hall, and we used to play throughout their dinner. Strange enough, we used interesting in their food, because they used to bring fish, and any type of seafood was always brought in whole on the dish. And when they finished, it always just was left with the bones. Everything of the thing was stripped. Just the bones and perhaps a tail piece was left. And they used to be all so gay. We used to always enjoy when the first lot of champagne was opened, because everybody used to go real haywire. And the same with the English weddings we used to play at. They were mostly held at the hotels, the big Hong Kong hotel and the Gloucester hotel on the dance floor. They used to hold the weddings. And the tradition then was that the bride and the groom always took to the floor first, and then the parents of the grooms. And if we were playing, we always used to like to see the first bottle or two of champagne get round, because everybody used to get so excitable. We used to play quite a number of cocktail dances and 21st birthday parties. I remember one morning, an afternoon, we were playing at the Happy Valley Racecourse military band, and the bandmaster said that the people who were playing at the 21st birthday party fall out and get changed. And we left the Happy Valley, five of us, came back to the barracks, changed into our afternoon mess dress, it was about half past three, I suppose, and went to the top of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, where we were playing for the, I suppose he was the manager or the director, Grayson, Sir something Grayson. His daughter was having a 21st birthday party right at the very top of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. And it was a most marvellous do we had there. After about an hour's playing, everybody was well and truly liquored up. And Grayson, or his secretary, I forget which now, came and said, "Are you in charge of the band?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, for God's sake, get your people out of here." He said, "Everybody's going crazy." All the drink and the type of music we were playing. We played what the girls asked for. And we left with plenty of liquor stowed away in our music cases. And we always managed to get a few bottles in the case of the trombones, the music satchel that I used to carry around. And later in the evening, we went back and we played for a dance till about 4 o'clock in the morning. They had a lot of greenery and shrubbery, although it was right on the top of the bank. I remember a lot of disappearing tricks took place from the shrubbery. And when we went back, my wife and I, we went to cash some traveller's checks in the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. I said, "Do you remember I told you about the 21st birthday party we paid at for somebody by the name of Grace?" And she said, "Yes." So we looked at the tablets on the wall, and it had listed all the former managers of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank in Hong Kong, and there was Sir Grayson's name there. So I said, "There you are." I said, "I was telling the truth."
What sort of privileges did you enjoy that ordinary soldiers didn't, in dress and parades and that sort
of thing? Well, of course, as I said, the whole units were entitled to civilian dress. And of course, owing to the heat, it was very casual. But we, of course, went out in evening dress, mess dress, to play. And we used to come in at all hours of the morning, because we had virtually permanent pass as members of the dance band, in any case. And I used to come in perhaps 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, just strolling in the mess dress. Never used to have to answer the guard room at all. Unless, for some reason or other, we'd answered it going out, and we so told the guard commander we'd be late. Privilege that we did get, if we were playing out a late dance, we were allowed to lay in the morning, miss the early morning parade. If we didn't get up for breakfast, we didn't have any. Perhaps at 7 o'clock, they used to perhaps give us an hour in bed of the morning. One of the jobs I played for was for a Russian ballet master. His name was Goncharov, and just up Garden Road, just before you arrived at the Peak Tram, he had his dance studio, and he asked, sent a letter to the band and asked if it was possible to have a pianist. By the way, we had three or four dance bands going. We had sufficient numbers in the band that we could carry more than one dance band. In fact, sometimes we used to have three, and I've even known a four-piece, a fourth dance band going up if we were really pushed with engagements, because it was all money. And Goncharov wrote in or came and saw the bandmaster and asked if he had a pianist who would be prepared to undertake playing for his ballet school. And I was very privileged to play for him. It was a marvellous experience because it gave me a great love for a type of music and dancing which I had never had up until then, and a great love of which has carried me right through to this day. Goncharov, incidentally, taught Margaret Fontaine when she lived in Shanghai for a period. I think her people were army or forces people. And she did some of her training in Shanghai, and Goncharov had the teaching of her.
What arrangements were made for pay when you were playing with the dance band? Or?
Well, I would... arrangements like that that were engaged virtually through the band, he would pay the band, and I would then, after a deduction of a fifth for the bandmaster, a fifth for the president of the regimental institutes, I would get the three-fifths. If I went and did something of my own, as a matter of courtesy and common sense, I would tell the bandmaster, and that would be all right, that would be my own. But to play at the ballet school, he used to start with his tiny tots of about 5 years old and go right up to his ballerinas who are in their 20s. And that sometimes our sessions used to, other work permitting, I used to play perhaps from 2 o'clock in the afternoon with about short breaks, perhaps till 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. I never knew that girls perspired until I played for ballet school. And the strange thing was, he never touched them with his hands. It was always, he always had a long pole, about 3 foot long, and they used to have these wall bars, or a long, long wall bar, in front of mirrors, and if he wanted to adjust their hands or the legs, it was always done with the stick. He'd always put their hands or legs into position with a touch of the stick. And I was somewhat slimmer than I am now, and he was pushed for male ballet dancers. He even suggested perhaps I'd like to learn to become a ballet student. But I couldn't face up to meeting my pals.
You also used to broadcast on Hong Kong radio, didn't you?
Yes. As I said before, we had a lot of cruisers come in, and quite a number of the Navy people used to be musical, of course. Cruisers would carry Royal Marines, and of course we got to know quite a number of the Marines because they used to come up to the band practice room. And HMS Kent, she was a county class cruiser, she came in and they had a very good quartet party on board, and a message was flashed, could they have a pianist from the Royal Scots to rehearse the Kent quartet, would he be prepared to rehearse the Kent quartet party? And there again, having the singing and the music in the way of the piano, it was an opportunity I really fell for. And I again have the privilege of rehearsing the Kent Quartet Party, and we broadcast over ZBW. We'd given quite, and did give, right up to the war, quite a number of broadcasts over ZBW, mostly dance band, but occasionally orchestra. A broadcast with the Kent Quartet Party. They were unaccompanied, but I did introduce one or two piano numbers. I also broadcast with the Cathedral Choir. We used to give a Sunday evening epilogue, and every Sunday evening at, I think it was used to be 3 minutes past ten, the Cathedral Quartet used to give an epilogue over the air. And I was actually in the studio about to give a rendering of the epilogue when they announced that war had broken out between the UK and Germany. And I was actually in the studio when that was read over the air. I think it was on a Sunday.
What sort of effect did that have on you and the rest of the members of the band and the battalion?
Well, we were so far away from the UK and all our loved ones that one loses, to a large extent, the touch of home. I mean, I'd been out there since 34. It was right around the 39. I shared the homes of quite a number of civilians. I'd got them the music, part of the Cathedral Choir. Music played a very, very big part in my life. And home as such was very, very remote. Even mother and father, and in the miss writing to my mother, every week I wrote to my mother right the way through India and right until war declared. Every week I wrote to mother and always had a letter from her right up until war broke out when, of course, everything went haywire. On one occasion, I had a letter that an aircraft had come down. It was when we were in India. An aircraft had come down and the mail went down with it, and I had a letter that was rescued from the ocean depths and was delivered with a suitable covering note that this had been rescued from the sea. But, no, I think it was so remote. Nothing had happened, really, to make us think that war was imminent. There was even the fact that the Germans occupied and attacked Poland, Sudetenland, and all those areas which were very much in the news. We still seemed that we'd soldier along and nothing would happen to us. I don't think we really thought about it until the Belgians and the French packed in, and there was Dunkirk. I think it was then that it hit us, what could possibly happen. Still, not where the Japanese were concerned. Never thought about the Japanese, I don't think. Not seriously. It was just a whirl of pleasure, really. We had what they called a flying picket that was ready to be called out. It comprised of a full-rank NCO, a lance corporal in the section, with Bren guns and ammunition. That was from 1939 onwards. That was prepared and always standing by. But I don't ever remember it being called out in anger. It was called out for training purposes, usually most evenings a week, any hour of the night. You were on standby and could be called out. But I don't ever remember it being called out in anger. We did have one scare. They thought there was some movement on the border. Of course, the Sino-Japanese war was on. They and Japanese were knocking hell out of the Chinese coastal regions at that particular time. There was the incidents on the Garden Bridge in Shanghai, where the British women had been pushed and poked around at in the settlement there. The international settlement, as it was known then. But we were still actually in Hong Kong, were remote. Right up until 39, there was quite a number of warships coming in. The Americans' warships used to come in. the Americans used not to come in any great force, so perhaps a cruiser and a couple of destroyers used to come ashore. They used to be so roughly handled by the garrison stationed in Hong Kong that two Americans at one time, if my memory serves me, were killed by artillerymen, I believe, who were stationed at Stanley. These Americans came in and took some of these girls who the garrison troops thought they were own from one of these dancing clubs. And they chased the Americans. The Americans ran and jumped in the water off the Wan Chai, and the artillerymen jumped in after them, and I think the two men were killed. Two Americans were killed. Things were so bad that the whole garrison was paraded and addressed by the commanding garrison commander, General Grisset, to the effect that we were causing these distress to a potential ally, and that if any more incidents had taken place between the garrison troops and visiting Americans, the whole garrison would be confined to barracks for the period of the American sojourn in Hong Kong. The trouble was, of course, the Americans always had so much more money to flash around, and these girls, those that were so minded, would naturally go where the money was easiest to find. It was always a bone of contention. I mean, they were better dressed. Their uniform was more a super fine drill. We had somewhat similar things in India when we were stationed close to the Air Force. The Air Force were better messed, better paid, and better dressed than the Army man was. And that, unfortunately, always raised them a bone of contention. It seems most unfair on looking back, and it was something that should have been rectified, I feel. It was only until very recent years, under this present government, that the army man and the serviceman generally has been paid to bring him in ranks and do away with that terrible inferiority complex, which did so much, really, to sour relations between potential allies.
Where were you of the Japanese threat at that time?
Well, life went on very, very gaily until we had a complete change of colonial secretary, governor, and general officer commanding, and the admiral commanding. They took the whole lot away somewhere in 39-40. We had one or two visits from, I think, was it Percival, and an Air Force Air Marshal. Air Commodore Brooke Popham came out to see us, and he told us that the Japanese were a potential ally, but we're not to worry about them, because we have far better equipment. Their stuff was all made of cardboard. They couldn't shoot straight. They couldn't pilot an aircraft. They're all cross-eyed and wore glasses. Oh, and their stuff was all made of cardboard. And we had nothing to worry about there. And the whole booster.
What year was that?
Oh, that must have been about 19... When did the war break out there? 41, was it? It must have been about 40 or early 41. Oh, yes, we were marvellous. We had nothing to worry about. However, the new governor arrived, Maltby arrived. He was definitely anti-Royal Scots. I've read since, we thought it at the time, and I've read since it was true, that he must have been in the 41, I suppose, when he took over. He promptly turfed us out of Murray Barracks and put us way up on the border, right up in the New Territories, right up on the Shum Chun River, just behind Lo Wu. And the Middlesex Regiment, who'd done all their training on the mainland, they brought them over to Murray Barracks and put them in the pillboxes that we'd trained under. But that's jumping on a bit, because from 1939 onwards, they started building air raid shelters in Hong Kong. And these were built very close, some of them were built very closely to our barracks. The opening was from Queen's Road and Garden Road, and they drilled with these compressors, and the drilling went on day and night and day and night, and the noise was so terrific that when you went to sleep, when they stopped for any reason, you would wake up. You got so used to the day and night noise. But these had been under construction for some time. When all hell broke loose in Hong Kong, about all the corruption that was going on between certain people on, I think, the government and the army who were responsible for the construction of the air raid shelters and pillboxes, and some of the civilian contractors. Of course, Squeeze, it's well known in Hong Kong. I mean, everybody was out for Squeeze, or Cumshaw. Was it called Cumshaw in Hong Kong, or was that the Indian expression? But everybody was on the make. I mean, contractors to make the pillboxes, instead of them being perhaps 3-in-1 sand in and cement, they were 9-in-1. And somebody was getting a terrific rake off. I mean, a newcomer to the colony, they went in their office and they'd find a bunch of flowers in there as a welcome. If they accepted them flowers, they'd had it. I mean, the squeeze was put on them. And squeeze was rife in Hong Kong. The pillboxes, I mean, when the Japanese opened fire, and the bloody bullets went through the pillboxes. There was just no cement in the damn things to hold together. And, of course, the papers were full of this blooming, the squeeze and rackets that were going on for on the building of these air raid shelters. One of the Chinese girls involved, she was the equivalent, I suppose, of Mandy Rice Davis and Christine Keto, as we know them today. She had a somewhat similar effect on the government and the people concerned in Hong Kong. Her name was Mimi Lau. I remember that name very well, because when I was wounded and lying on the floor of the Hong Kong hotel, which had been turned into something of a hospital, Mimi Lau was one of my nurses, and very, very attractive nurse, and a very good nurse she was too. But can we stop for a bit? I think life was still very, very gay in Hong Kong, in spite of the threat of the air raid shelters. Quite a number of big dances were held, and a lot of them were held for the Red Cross. And what took the imagination quite a lot was the Spitfire.